It's gonna go off.
All right. I will call, say date. Today is April 3rd, April 3rd, regular meeting of Fluvana County Board of Supervisors. We will begin now with a pledge of allegiance followed by due course of silence.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
All right. Now we'll adopt the agenda for the meeting. Are there any recommended changes or other updates?
No.
Okay.
I move to approve the agenda.
Yep, a second.
There's been a motion to approve the agenda. It's seconded by Mrs. Seeger. Chair votes aye. We'll now begin with a short presentation, special presentation for the 2019 Victim Perseverance Award presented by Jeff Facelift, Commonwealth Attorney and Sheriff Stater, Victim Witness Advocate.
Hello, thank you.
Thank you all for letting me go along with Tom on your agenda. So as you know, I'm Sheriff Stater. I'm the Victim Advocate here in Fluvana County. Next week is National Crime Victims Rights Week, April 7th through 13th, and it's a week that's dedicated to crime victims and the advocates that serve them. You may recall a few years ago, we presented our very first Victim Perseverance Award to Lisa Black. And thereafter, we named our award the Lisa Black Victim Perseverance Award. Lisa was a victim of a horrific DUI crash where she suffered significant and permanent injury, which will affect her basically for the rest of her life. And I'm so happy to say that Lisa's here today and is going to come up and join us. So I'm going to make this really short because Jeff's going to do most of the presentation, but I just want to say that as a victim advocate, I absolutely love my job because I get to meet the most incredible, strong people in the world. Just working with crime victims every day, I just witness things that would make most people just wonder how in the world people get through some of the things they get through. Jeff and I work real hard, and today we're going to be honoring several individuals who persevered through a significant event in their life, as well as a complicated and frustrating criminal justice process. They showed so much strength, and I just admire them so very much, as I do Lisa and our previous awardee, Nadia Anderson. So now I'm going to turn it over to Jeff, and he's going to tell you about the events that altered their lives forever and which brings us here today.
Thank you again. We're going to be taking a little bit more time today than we normally do. The last 2 years we've had one recipient, but this year, because of some very unusual events we had in Fluvana, we've got two different groups, one individual and one group of recipients. And when we were thinking about who we were going to give it to this year, because both cases ended up last year, we couldn't separate the two, so we decided we just had to give one to everybody that's involved. And I think you'll know why when you hear. The recipients that we have this year have one thing in common, and thankfully it's a very rare thing here in this wonderful county, but what they all have in common is that they had someone shoot at them with bad intentions. And again, we don't see that very often, but we had a couple instances of just really surreal behavior in this county that we don't see in this county, but these folks unfortunately had it visited upon them. First person we're going to call for is Jackie Gillespie. Jackie, if you could come up, please. I'm going to say a few words about what Jackie went through and what he did before he gets his award. So Jackie, if you hang out, I'll tell the folks about your situation. Back on November 18th, you may recognize Jackie, first of all. He was interim sheriff here for a while and served decades here on the Fluvana County Sheriff's Office and served every rank in the courts and just did everything you can do in the sheriff's office for Fluvana for, 29 years? 33 years. So Jackie's well known to us in law enforcement here. But back on November 18, 2016, Jackie and a couple of his friends were working on some vehicles in a garage here in Fluvana at the friend's garage. They left the garage on a sunny day to go out and pull an engine from a bus on the far end of the property. And unbeknownst to them, while they were gone, three individuals came in to the garage to steal some guns that they believed were going to be there. Well, the guns had been removed a few weeks before, but they didn't know that. So the individuals were in the garage, the guns weren't there, so they were in a bad mood. Jackie's friend showed up first. They all showed up together, but Jackie's friend walks into the garage first, and someone starts firing a 45 at him, just without that person even knowing any of us was in the garage. Just suddenly he's being shot at. One of the bullets goes through the person's leg. He's hit. Jackie, hearing the gunshots, responds as a former law enforcement officer would. He pulls his revolver. He's confronted by an individual holding a gun with a mask over his face who begins shooting at Jackie. And instead of doing like I, and I think everybody, most people I know would do, running the other way, Jackie actually pointed his gun revolver at the individual walking towards him, firing, and had that person retreat so he could get into the garage to help his friend. Jackie took up a position inside the garage. The garage, one of the big garage bay doors was here, and the small regular door that you would come into the garage was here. Very thin piece of concrete, a cinder block wall. Jackie standing behind the wall, yelling out to see if his friend's okay. His friend is telling him, watch out, he's still there, he's got the gun. As the person, Gary Blow is his name, drives off, he's in the SUV they had left there running. He's still shooting at Jackie, hanging his arm out the window, shooting his 45 at Jackie as he's driving off. And Jackie, again, showing courage, I don't recognize or don't think I could summon, comes around from behind the wall and shoots at the vehicle as it's leaving. The vehicle was left at a parking lot in Doswell near King's Dominion for a day. And then they picked it up, the bad guys picked it up and took the SUV to a garage in Norfolk area where it was hidden for months. And when it was recovered, it had bullets in the side and in the front windshield where Jackie had emptied his revolver into the vehicle trying to stop the stop Gary Blow from getting away. Jackie called 911 twice, trying to get the police there and checking on the status of the police while helping his injured friend. Got on the Gator and drove out to the road to meet the officers, and actually was there when they arrested the people who were caught at the end of the driveway. He helped law enforcement throughout, met with me at the scene and one of the investigators, and we walked through and looked at all the bullet holes in the garage. And it was literally like a scene out of a movie. It was just an amazing thing, all the action that took place in that garage that day. But Jackie stuck with us, and when he thought of something new that he hadn't told us before, he came to the office and told me about it. He did a diagram for the officers that we actually used as an exhibit in the trial. He testified at the preliminary hearing and at the trial. And as I told the jury at the trial and the judge at the sentencing, I honestly believe that if Jackie hadn't reacted the way he did, Gary Blow would have left three dead people there and would have driven out of there, because he was going to go over and through anybody he needed to get out of that garage. And Jackie was there, thankfully, and I was able to fend him off. But because of his hard work in this and in his, no other word for it, heroic actions, that man, is serving 42 year sentence right now. And because of Jackie's willingness to stick through a long system, it took well over a year to get this thing to trial and deal with it, and he was with us the whole way. We are very proud to make him one of the recipients this year of our Lisa Black Victim Perseverance Award, and we're very proud for him to have that as a, I know he doesn't need a reminder of this horrible day, but he really deserves all of our respect. And while Jackie's situation is an example of how randomly and instantly violent crime can change someone's lives, that literally in a second their life went from a sunny November morning to being in a life-threatening gunfight, our next group of recipients show that sometimes people are subjected to abuse over a period of years, and they're in a situation that they have to deal with and persevere over years that eventually culminated to a horrible event. But the next group I'd like to call up is Mike and Judy Townsend, Sarah Williams, and Kimberly and Caleb Clements. If you can come forward, please. And And these folks live in a very quiet, what was a very nice, it is a very nice neighborhood in Fluvanna, the Hardware Hill Circle area, but there was one very big problem with that neighborhood, and that was Joe Roach. And Joe Roach was a black cloud over that neighborhood. Everybody in the neighborhood had to keep an eye on him. He would drink, he would curse the neighbors, he would shoot his guns, he would play loud music. And that this went on for years and years and years. And these folks, the Townsends live right next door to them, and the Clemenses live across the street. And they, you know, you never get used to that, but that was just Joe being Joe. Well, one day in April 29, 2017, even they could tell something was different with Joe. He was darker, he was being nastier, and they all said, you know, it's worse than usual. Well, these folks were standing out in the yard, Mike and Judy and Caleb and Kimberly were standing out in the driveway talking, and Joe just began firing at them with a high-powered rifle. Mike testified at the preliminary and trial how he saw the flame from the muzzle blast from the next door neighbor's house, and the leaves on the trees actually move as the bullets were heading in their direction. Even with this going on, helped Kimberly and Caleb walk across the street to their house. And as they're walking down the driveway, Joe Roach is still shooting at the three of them, saying he's going to kill them, and shooting a high-powered rifle in their direction as they're walking across the road to the house. As they got to their house, Kimberly noticed that Roach had left his side porch where he was shooting at the next door neighbors and at them, and had gone to the front porch to get a better aim at them because they were directly across the street. She heard a bullet hit the house as she entered the house, but she and Caleb entered the house. And Mike went back to his property, and Joe Roach continued to yell and shoot at him. Judy went in the house and called 911, and their daughter Sarah was there within minutes. She lived close by. And when Sarah got there, she went in the house trying to calm down Judy, and Mike was still outside, and bullets still flying. Bullets hit the house, they hit the carport, they hit the car, they hit the deck, they hit it, just, you know, just peppering the side of their house and their property with bullets. One of the bullets went through the outside wall of the house and into a den area where Judy was standing in the doorway of, and actually struck a deer head that was on the wall and shattered the antlers off of the deer head and left a hole in the wall. You could see out from outside the house from in that room. As Sarah was trying to get her parents, you know, together in the house, she went back out on the deck to try to get her father, and she opened the kitchen door, and Joe Roach shot again. The bullet hit a swing that was on the porch, and a fragment of the bullet, or the bullet itself, struck her in the eye, in the corner of the eye, and cut her eye open. If it had been just millimeters in the other direction, it would have probably killed her. The doctors told her that night. Soon thereafter, the police arrived, and after a 7-hour standoff, Joe Roach was arrested and charged with multiple offenses. Sherry and I went out the next day, the Monday following this weekend event, most of the night, Saturday night. And as we walked the property, and I was taking pictures and we were talking to them, I was just struck by how strong and how tight this group of people was. And a lot of that, I'm sure, is probably because of the fact they had to be, just from being around him that long, and they just grown so close together. And they were all nervous about Joe Roach coming back to that neighborhood, but they were willing to put their faith in the system. And they came to preliminary hearing, trial, sentencing, testified multiple times. And it was a long, drawn-out process, but they stuck with us the whole way. And because of that, Joe Roach received a 58-year sentence, and he won't be back in their neighborhood again. And that's because they were willing to stand up for justice on those rights. So for that reason, we're going to make Mike and Judy Townsend, Sarah Williams, and Kimberly, and Caleb Clements more recipients of the Lisa Black Victim Perseverance Award.
Thanks for being there, because we definitely need it.
We have, because we've had
Well, you don't have to run.
The law officers that put their lives ahead of theirs to try to help us. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Mr. Haislip. Thank you, Mrs. Stafford, Stater, and Mrs. Black, and of course to the victims, Mr. Ulifsky, Mr. Townsend, and Mr. Clements. Moments like this remind us just how fragile life is and how lucky we are to have people that serve us and protect us. And of course, it still doesn't make the process of having been victimized any easier, but it's nice to know that everything turned out all right in this case. So thank you all very much. Moving on, we will now hear from the county administrator, Mr. Nichols.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, just a couple of quick things. The Savannah Department of Social Services was awarded, one of six out of 26 localities, was awarded a certificate because they had 0% error on the SNAP payment statistics that are tracked, which is great. That's a pretty impressive six out of 26. Those are not easy programs to get right and get it on track. And get the error rate down, but they've got zero error rate in the fiscal year 18 time frame. So congratulations to our social services colleagues. The high school did their hands-on Savannah at Pleasant Grove Park on the 29th, and a lot of high school kids out there working on a lot of different projects at the community garden and the trails, and then the butterfly garden. So you can see them all out there. They picked up obviously a really good day. It was pretty nice out there that day compared to what some days have been over the past year. Really pleased with their work and their help in the community. Also want to remind you, we've got a community meeting coming up in Columbia on April 15th. That's a town hall meeting along with the CARE Task Force to talk about sewer system services and problems in the Columbia area. We'll have representatives from our contract engineers, the health department, and county staff there to address issues and answer questions and try to collect information from all the residents. So anyone that's interested in the Columbia area, please come out at 6 o'clock on the 15th, be at the parish hall. And then the VACO certified supervisors course, we normally, Eric and I, or myself and Mrs. Booker or other supervisors over the past few years, had normally done part of that course every year. They've asked us to do it again this year. I'm going to be gone on the 12th, but Erica is going to do that. And we're interested in a supervisor, if there's one available that afternoon to work with Eric to attend that. It'll be here in the Morris Room. And available, Mr. O'Brien?
Sure.
Can you do it at 1 o'clock on a Friday?
Yeah.
Okay, we'll get it on your calendar. It's just nice having two people there to kind of tag team and answer questions. And so that'll be helpful. That certified supervisor's course is important, and it's done every year, but it gets representatives from Board of Supervisors from all around the Commonwealth, and they just happen to have one of their classes here in Savannah County. And then just a reminder on your upcoming board meeting schedule. You've already been through the 20th and the 27th. Those change, but all this other stuff on here all slid down a week. So remember, on your original schedule, April 10th is when you're going to have a public hearing. April 10th, there's nothing that night now. So April 10th is an open night. April 17th, your regular meeting at 7 o'clock, you'll have a 4 o'clock work session. I think Ms. Harris has already gotten this all on your calendars. But then you're actually due a budget adoption on the 24th. So this is showing the old calendar. I've got another one later on. We'll show you the new dates on there. I sent that to you electronically, and she put it on your calendars. But just remember, nothing next week. Back on the 17th, 4 o'clock work session, 7 o'clock meeting. And then the special meeting the following week. Any questions I can answer for the board, please?
No. Okay. We will now open our first round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board, come to the podium and state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments to 5 minutes on topic and directly to the board. Anyone wishing to address the board at this time?
Good afternoon. Leonard Boza, 26 Fleetwood Drive, Palmyra. I've come before you this afternoon to officially advise you that after 11 years on the board of directors of the Lake Monticello Volunteer Fire and Rescue, and 8 of those years as president of the corporation, that I am resigning both of those positions. And I thought it was only appropriate that I come personally thank each of you for the respect and cooperation that you've shown me over those 11 years as we worked together to address a number of issues that faced Lake Monticello Fire and Rescue as well as Flavanna Fire and Rescue countywide. I believe that working together, we've accomplished a great deal. And I believe that you've always been attentive and caring and made your best effort to help us address the issues that faced our organization so we can provide the best services to the residents of Flavanna County. And I wanted to personally thank you for that. And while I'm here, I also wanted to thank Steve Nichols and Eric Dahl and everyone in their offices, because every time I came to speak to them or to deal with whatever had to be dealt with, they're always welcoming, and it was a pleasure to work with the county representatives. So again, my sincere thanks. The reason I've stepped down is we are now the proud grandparents of a 6-month-old baby in Emily in Long Island, and we also have purchased a home in Vero Beach, Florida. So we're going to try the snowbird life, wintering in Florida and summering in springtime here in beautiful Flavanna County. So I just wanted you to know that I really appreciate everything you've done for us. And thank you very much.
Congratulations.
Yeah. And we certainly owe you our thanks. And I know you've worked tirelessly for the FRA. And we thank you for all your efforts.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure. Thank you. Take care now.
Thank you.
There are no public hearings today, so we will now move on to action matters. Let's see. First action matter is Child Abuse Awareness Prevention Month Proclamation and Social Services Update. Rocky Reed from CPS.
Okay. Thank you. So good afternoon. I'm Rocky Reed. I'm the CPS supervisor at Flavanna County Department of Social Services. In our CPS unit, Nikki, Sarah, and Rosa were not able to be here today, but we do have Tia Giannini, a CPS worker, and our director, Kim Mabe, here as well. So April is National Child Abuse Prevention Month, and I would like to provide you with the mission and the vision statement of the Virginia Department of Social Services. The mission is from people helping people triumph over poverty, abuse, and neglect to shape strong futures for themselves and their families and the communities. The vision is a commonwealth in which individuals and families have access to adequate, affordable, high-quality human social services that enable them to be the best they can be. During the state fiscal year 2018 in Virginia, there were 55,255 children reported as possible victims of abuse and neglect. Of those children, 36,857 completed reports were accepted by Department of Social Services. Of those, 1,954 was reports of substance exposed infants. Most cases of suspected abuse and neglect come from educators, and that's because outside of the home, educators are the ones that spend the most time with school-age families. But again, reports can come from anywhere, and it can also be anonymous. Recognizing child abuse, a lot of people think of physical harm as child abuse, but there are other forms of child abuse, including physical neglect, sexual abuse, emotional, and medical abuse as well. Most children are subject to more than one type of abuse, and usually it happens over a period of time. For the annual report in Flavanna County, for the time period shown, we received 303 referrals, where there were 86 family assessments open for services and 25 investigations. Also, there was 120 cases that were worked with law enforcement and or the Commonwealth Attorney. So we worked closely with law enforcement, even in cases that might not meet the criteria We also provide resources, informational resources, such as to the food banks, court services, or benefit services at DSS. We also provide ongoing cases for high-risk cases once their investigations or family services once they are closed, as well as prevention cases for people with moderate risk of future abuse of neglect, or it can also be court-ordered. So this graph shows a breakdown of the types of abuse reported during the annual report for Fluvanna County. As you can tell, that there were 84 children that were subjected to mental abuse and neglect. This also includes children that were exposed to domestic violence in the home or with their families. 171 children were physically neglected. That includes inadequate supervision or not having the basic needs met with food or shelter. Also, there were 31 children that was a subject of possible sexual abuse. 19 of those were investigated and 13 were found to have been sexually abused. There were 10 cases of substance-exposed infants. So this shows that child abuse and neglect does happen in our county, and it is very important that we look into those areas. So if you suspect a child is being abused or neglected, please say something. Call your local DSS or the Child Abuse and Neglect Hotline, because it should not hurt to be a child. Thank you.
Any questions?
No. So Board Members, you'll have a proclamation that's in your package. You can see there on the screen, and there's a motion to approve that proclamation celebrating children in the month of April.
I move the Fluvanna County Board of Supervisors proclaiming the month of April 2019 as Celebrating Children Month in Fluvanna County in observation of Child Abuse Prevention Month.
Thank you. Motion has been made by Mrs. Eager and seconded by Mr. Weaver. May I have a vote, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-0. The next matter is, the next action matter is from Jessica Rice, Assistant Director of Public Works Utility Position.
Good afternoon. So this afternoon we're presenting a position description for an assistant director, and they would be overseeing all of the utilities operations in the county, including Fuzzy, Zion Crossroads, the school sewer system, and all the other water systems in the county. Right now, Public Works has a director and an assistant director. That assistant director mostly focuses on grounds, facilities, maintenance, fleet, the convenience center and stuff like that. And so with the growing infrastructure in the county and the additional personnel that may have to come on board down the road, we're looking to implement a different division in Public Works, and there will be an assistant director overseeing that division. So one director, two assistant directors, and that will help better oversee the whole department for based on the county's needs at the time. What questions do you have about the position?
Okay, I noticed the top salary goes up to $75,000. You're putting in $43,000 new. Obviously, you had probably about $33,000 already in up until the end of this fiscal year.
There was money in from previous position, and then the additional that would supplement what's already there is in the FY20 budget in the county administrator's budget. And so what we're looking to do is advertise the position and have this person start on July 1st. So in the FY20 fiscal year, the funding will be there.
It'd be about $76,000 and 43, and if you have 33 in now, which should be added.
You're actually right? $51,900 in fiscal year 20 budget, and then there was 43 budgeted in fiscal year 18 that hasn't been filled. But the 51.9 was a half year's funding for a full director. We've backed that down to an assistant director. So between the two, the pot that was approved before that hasn't been filled, we've transferred that to this. So you'll have, I think, just about the right amount for pay and benefits in fiscal year 20. So I don't think we'll have to be any new money that's not already listed there.
Any other questions?
Ready for a motion? I move to approve the new position description number 7510, Assistant Director of Public Works Utility, pay band 19 as presented.
Second.
Motion has been made by Mr. Wheeler, seconded by Ms. Yeager. May I have a vote, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. The motion passes 2-0. Next action matter, Mr. Eric Dahl, public hearing advertisement of lease agreement and Shenandoah Personal Communications LLC.
Mr. Chair, members of the board, what I have before you is an advertisement for a lease that the county is entering into with Shenandoah Personal Communications for them to put equipment on one of our Brema Bluff water storage tanks. So it'll provide additional service to that area, but just with any type of disposal, which is considered disposable of county property. We're not disposing of it, but we're leasing out county property. We have to have a public hearing and we have to advertise it. So one, public hearing requirements, and then we've gone through the county attorney's office for all the legal components of this. And we actually just got back, Mr. Payne just actually gave me the signed agreement from Shenandoah already on their behalf. So then once we go through this process, then if the county approves it, then we'll move forward. But again, per Virginia code, a lease is considered a disposal of public property. Again, we're not disposing of the property, we're just leasing it out. And then we have to have advertisement for this, and we're gonna be having advertisement in the Fluvanna Review in tomorrow and then on April 11th. So the lease information, this agreement allows a tenant Shenandoah Personal Communications, which is actually Shentel, if you've heard of Shentel, to operate their telecommunications equipment down on the Brema Bluff storage tank. The annual lease amount is $18,000, and the initial term will be for 5 years. And then there's also some escalation clauses in the out years for 3%.
Is that 3% per year?
It is 3% per year, yes. And that's really all I have. And basically, the motion is just to ratify the advertisement to go into the Fluvanna Review. We'll have a public hearing on it. I think the public hearing is going to be on April 17th. And then at the April 17th meeting, we would then have the actual lease agreement for the board to consider and to approve of that at that time after the public hearing. Any questions? If not, there's a motion up on
yes,
the screen.
Yes, I have a question.
Sure.
The Brema Bluff water storage tank, who paid for that?
That's FUSD. It's a FUSD tank, and
they paid for it.
They paid for the tank, the debt service for the tank. That's FUSD. The revenue for this will be going to FUSD.
Right. Okay.
Yep. So right now they actually have.
And that's actually good because they're running in the black now.
Yeah.
They've paid back all the debt to us. Now they can start building up their fund balance.
It's good.
So for capital improvements.
They have they're
best shape now than they've ever been. Absolutely. At least since I've been
here. Mr. Stevens and the FUSD folks did a great job of really turning around. Now you'll be getting also a new rate increase for. It'll be coming forward sometime with the next few months, because that was the next sequence of going on. It'd be like, I think it's a penny or two.
Yeah.
Yep. And existing on this water storage tank, there's already two carriers. So this will be the third carrier on that tank, and they'll be pretty much at capacity for carriers on that water storage tank. So if I can take any other questions.
And all of the money goes to FUSD,
goes
correct?
To FUSD, yep.
I move the Board of Supervisors ratify advertisement of a public hearing to be held on April 17th, 2019 for the telecommunications site deed of lease agreement of county property on the Brema Bluff water storage tank to Shenandoah Personal Communications LLC for the purposes to install, maintain, and operate the telecommunications equipment, antennas, and appurtenances laid out in the agreement.
Second.
Motion has been made by Mrs. Yeager and seconded by Mr. Wheeler. May I vote, please?
Aye.
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-0. That's it for action matters. There are no appointments. There are no presentations. We now move to the consent agenda.
And on the consent agenda, when you go through it, I'm just going to show you one thing. On the second page, on tab N, the additional duties increase, you can see on your screen, it's instead of March 18th, it's March 25th, is when that would become effective.
Are there any other items that need to be pulled from the consent agenda?
Are you going to sort of list them?
Yep. List them here. Consent agenda, item number D, proclaiming April 7th, 2019 National Hispanic Victim Rights Week. Item E, CRMF request, admin, courts, building, sidewalk repairs and modifications. Item F, ZXR, ZBEC right-of-way agreements. Item G, ZXR third-party welding and coating inspections. Item H, CRMF request, FCPS, FCHS, pH filter tank replacement. Item I, CRMF request, Flagana County Public Schools, FMS annex gym wall. Item J, CRMF request, FCPS, FMS office area roof. Item K, CRMF request, FCPS, FMS window and glass. Item L, CRMF request, PW19-011, dog park. Item M, telephone system project staff bonus. Item N, temporary staff compensation for additional duties. Item O, FY19 FCPS transportation fleet CIP transfer. Item P, FY19 BOS contingency budget transfer. DJPC Regional Housing Summit sponsorship. Okay.
Number N, though, mm-hmm. I'd like to ask a question about that. N.
N, okay.
Mm-hmm. is it possible that Ms. Roberts continue to do this job and we not hire someone else? No? Can you tell me why?
Because I don't think the treasurer, well, you're going to have to ask treasurer. It's her department. I doubt that she would be willing to operate with one less person.
Okay, but we don't have any say in that, correct?
Yes, of course you do. It's a nuanced thing when you're dealing with constitutional officers. And so it really is a conversation you need to have with Ms. Leonard. The positions that she's got are not all funded by the state, because not all constitutional officer positions are funded, but historically that's what she's run the office with five staff and herself. I'm not sure that Ms. Roberts is gonna take the chief deputy's position. She's just taking on some extra duties now. But Mrs. Leonard's probably gonna have to answer that question for you. I expect I can anticipate the answer, but
this, these staff members and the one we're talking about now, mm-hmm. that has been there for quite a few years, or some years, right? In the past.
At least the last 10 years.
Yes.
There's been the treasurer and five staff members.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
One of the things just to note, too, is that I think just about everyone in the office is picking up a little bit extra to try and fill in. But the one that we're asking for additional pay for is picking up a lot of the significant workload and stuff, and so that's why we're requesting the additional pay. So I don't know if that's sustainable long term, but it's certainly, we could certainly have a conversation about it and then see what, you know, what the treasurer thinks or what she would like to do.
Ask Ms. Leonard to be at the work session on the 17th and confess it then.
Yep.
I just asked because when I was working at one of the offices in New York, my boss said, well, I need to hire another person. And I said, if you give me half of what you're going to pay her, I'll do the job.
Sure.
And he was happy he didn't have to deal with another person.
and you made out.
And I got some more money, right. I just had to get to the office a couple hours early.
Sometimes that's perfectly acceptable. And there are ways to do efficiencies where you can give some extra money or time or whatever and do it. And in a department where you've got, you know, 100 hours of overtime, I'm not suggesting treasurers, but in a department where you had 100 hours of overtime in the year, well, there's no sense to even consider hiring an extra person. If you've got, you know, 1,500 hours of overtime a year, then you may want to consider looking at another person, because that's almost near a full body. But it depends on how much you can sustain, what needs to be done with the existing staff. I bet there are a variety of different opinions about what it takes to staff the treasurer's office, but the conversation needs to be had with the treasurer herself, and we'll ask her to address it at the work session on the 7th.
Yeah, I think that would be a good idea. I mean, I'm not saying that she shouldn't have the fifth person, but...
No, there may be a way to realign, and it's a good conversation to have with her.
Are you saying you think we then should pull this item?
No. Oh, no, absolutely not. This is... So, for instance, if today somebody was out on sick leave for the next 3 months and we had to pick up some extra duties, we would want someone to pick up some of those extra duties. And if it's a substantial amount, if it's not just, you know, I got to do an extra 5 minute thing a week, but if I'm picking up substantial duties, we historically have always given them a little bit extra. So these duties are going to be picked up by Ms. Roberts. Whether you hire the full fifth person or not is a separate discussion. This definitely shouldn't be tabled, in my view. It should be go ahead now, because she's actually started the duties as of last Monday.
So this is just to give Ms. Roberts some more money, not
temporarily.
Some extra duties while they're thinking about or working on filling the empty
fifth
position.
That's what I had now.
Yeah, and we delayed it because we originally had it for March 18th, but actually the duties got delayed a week, and so we just pushed the date back a week. It's no sense to start when the duties haven't started. So.
Okay, I have one that I would like for you to look at, and that is F. I'm sort of curious, when you come down to discussion, and you come down to the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 sentences up from the bottom, it says the county will reimburse CVAC for their field representative expenses at the hourly rate of $110 up to not to exceed total under each agreement of $10,000. Yet, when you look down further, fiscal impact, it says NA. So, they're sort of contradicting them, or do I not understand it?
No, you're right. We probably should have filled in the fiscal impact part of it. We don't expect there's going to be much cost to this, but the cost is already part of the Zion Crossroads project. The project costs are already budgeted, including things like this. But we don't ever know what it's going to be until the project gets underway.
I understand that.
The CVAC engineer may have to be out there or may not be. So we could have put it in there that, should it have mentioned, that any costs associated with this up to that $10,000, if the full amount ever gets spent, is part of the existing budget approved by the Board of Supervisors previously.
Okay, and J, just more or less a comment on J. It says, you go down to description, it says this part of the FMS roof system has been leaking for many years. Well, I'm wondering why they're bringing it up now. If it's been leaking for many years, why they didn't do it earlier? That's my question, nothing else.
Excellent question. It's a school system request. I can't answer that, sir.
Okay.
Good. All right. We have a motion for consent agenda.
I move to approve the consent agenda. D through P.
Second.
Consent agenda from Mr. Weaver, seconded by Mr. Eager. May I vote, please?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-0. Next, unfinished business. Rural cluster subdivision discussion.
So it's been talked about a number of times with the incredible interest in the Island Hill subdivision over near Lake Monticello and Broken Island. The board has had a number of discussions about this during the approval process for that by right subdivision, Island Hill. And a number of board members have met with citizens at different times. Staff has met with citizens. And so there's a potential for the board to revisit what our ordinances say now on how we approve and what the rules are associated with rural cluster subdivision. So I just introduced the topic for discussion for you to have discussion and to give staff direction on what you'd like to see as a process going forward to get the Planning Commission to readdress or reassess, come up with alternatives and options, present to the board what's the board's will.
I definitely think that we need to re-look at this, and I think Tony would agree after being at the Monday, March 25th
meeting?
Yeah, there was a meeting, Island Health Subdivision, organized by them, and there were about 50 people there. A lot of great questions were asked. A presentation was made by the son of Mrs. Hill, I think.
Mrs. Lee.
Lee, thank you.
No, her first name is Lee. Lee Hinkle.
Lee Hill. Lee Hinkle. And he's an architect, and he covered a fair amount of different examples of how cluster subdivisions might be worked differently than the way we're doing them. Highlighted the fact that our ordinances are essentially not specified in any great detail, and so that there were, you know, areas where, even though the intention of a cluster subdivision is a good one, in the case of how Island Hill is being developed, it certainly caused a lot of consternation to a lot of the residents there. Simple things such as buffer lines, you know, the application of the open area space, I think how they can plan the community so it looks more rural in nature and has more shared areas that are essentially covering, that hiding the houses, if you would, just to make it a better and more attractive place. And as we continue to grow and have more of these by right subdivisions come about, I think that the planning department could review ordinances that are coming from that other counties have and make some recommendations to the planning commission so that they can then move up to us.
One of the things that our zoning ordinance does is in A1 you need your back lot has to be 75 feet deep, but on the rural cluster it's 25.
Right.
So what happens, and we didn't think this through, we could have put something in there that says that there has to be so much buffer around it to protect the rural areas next to
That's good.
Or the homes, going right up to Riverside. I don't think that was our intention to get so close to each other. So that's one thing we should look into. Another thing that was brought to my attention was that our GIS is not as, the county of Fluvanna's GIS is notoriously off, and that we need to actually have a physical survey of what's out there to know that this is right. And I think that the yield plan for Island Hill should really be looked at very, very carefully, because I don't think it's what was intended by our ordinance. When you look at it, first of all, it's very tiny, so it's kind of hard to see, but the little tiny little black boxes are often in very steep slopes and wetlands. And there's also a creek that runs along the left side of Island Hill, and it runs all the time. It's not huge, but it's deep, and it takes a lot of water through there. So you can't put a house over the creek. And we really need to look at that to be sure that...
You can, actually. We have it in our county now.
I don't think it's a practice we want.
Well, maybe not, but we do have houses that are built over creeks already. Well, a creek running underneath the house.
Okay.
Well, that's already covered by the ordinance, because there's a requirement for riparian buffer.
That's what I thought. So that I'm not sure that they've taken
that. Frank Lloyd Wright is dead, but it really doesn't matter, because the riparian buffer would cover that.
Right, and that's what I'm worried about, that the houses didn't take in that riparian buffer. So these are things that I think we should look at before we put our seal of approval on Island Hill to make sure that it does meet the spirit of our...
I don't think you have a seal of approval on Island Hill, ma'am, as current law states. Payne or the zoning administrator, I'm not sure how we would do that.
It's already been approved in our ordinances now, hasn't it? I mean, you can't change it.
It's an administrative approval at this point.
Hmm?
It's an administrative approval at this point. They just submit their plats to the planning department, and we review them and send them to the agencies for review. And if they meet the ordinances and the other agency requirements, we'll sign the plat, and it can be recorded.
But that's what I want you to take a really close look at, is the wetlands and the riparian buffers and the steep slopes.
We have a list of stuff, and we actually plan to bring some of this up at the Planning Commission work session next Tuesday.
Good.
But not on Island Hill.
Just generally about rural clusters.
Right. And I would even suggest that we have an outside surveyor take a look at Island Hill to be sure that it does what it's supposed to do by our law. And I think, Tony, you were there, you know that things were brought up about lawsuit, and it's a possibility.
Yeah, it's a possibility, sure.
But
it's not a possibility.
Well, they think it is.
Yeah, I don't know who told you that, but I guarantee he's not a lawyer. There's a case directly on that point.
Okay, but I still really want this to be right.
Yes, and staff certainly does too, Ms. Seeger, but you're seem to be requesting something that's completely out of the ordinary, and I'm not sure going down that path is what the board at large would want, because there's some cost associated with that. But
yeah.
Clearly, in the GIS system, and I don't think this is unique to Fluvanna County, I'm quite sure it's not, our GIS system has never been intended to be accurate down to the corner markers.
And there's a disclaimer on there.
There is on every GIS system in all the counties.
It's
not intended to be the property lines.
The confusion is the state aerial photography that we use is slightly off with what the property lines are that are data points. So there's always going to be a differential with that, just based on the sourcing of the state aerial photography.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure, Fred, you know, do you use when you're hunting, do you have one of those GPSs to know where you are? Oh, it's often, you know, where you think you are, the property line is going through your house.
Well, GPS is, I don't know, many people don't know this, but GPS was intentionally designed so that it's not accurate to, I think it's accurate to something like 10 or 15 feet.
But not to a legal standard.
It was done intentionally as a protection for the security of the military.
Mm-hmm.
So my GPS is not going to be that precise. I suspect the Defense Department could give you a precise figure.
I hope so.
Well, in this case, too, would we be having the county order up a survey and pay for a survey? Well, that's a slope that I'm not sure we want to get on, because what if the next development wants the county to pay for the survey? I'm not sure we can do that.
Well, can the county, can you look at it very, very closely? Can you tell? Is that in your expertise?
What is what?
If the yield plan is correct or not?
We make that determination. The Planning Commission made that determination when they made their approval in, I guess it was the February meeting.
For the board's information, what happened on this was the Planning Commission considered this, and there were some anomalies in the yield plan. I noted a couple of them myself, and at my suggestion, the Planning Commission deferred consideration of the yield plan and the sketch plan for the rural cluster pending resolution of those questions. The staff, and that is Mr. Stewart, Mr. Robinson, myself, Mr. Black, and somebody else.
Scott.
Maybe Mr. Miller. Met with the representative of the corporate developer, as well as his independent surveyor, and asked these questions. And they were, Mr. Stewart can give you more detail on what happened, but all of the issues were identified, specifically steep slopes, wetlands areas, riparian buffer areas, setbacks, all of those things were identified from the ordinance. And the question was asked, have you gone back and looked at these again to make sure that they're correct? There was one of them that was obviously incorrect. And there's no question that one was corrected when it came back to the Planning Commission. The surveyor said he had gone back and subsequently reported to Mr. Stewart's department that he had reviewed these things and provided, I don't know what kind of detail he provided, but provided his results to Mr. Robinson. Mr. Robinson was satisfied with it, reported back to the Planning Commission. That's what the Planning Commission approved. So Mr. Stewart's department has seen.
I just want to make the point that these are licensed professionals who are submitting these plans to us, and if engineers, surveyors, and they're putting their license on the line if they submit incorrect data.
So I think the question that, or maybe one of the things that wasn't clear, is does the yield plan have to compensate for, you know, for parts of the parcel that can't be built on?
Yes.
So, you know, it didn't seem like that yield plan, based on the topography and some of the wetlands, actually address that, just from a top level view.
That was exactly the question that concerned me at the Planning Commission meeting, concerned the staff, and that's why we did the further examination. One thing that a lot of people don't understand is our ordinance does not prohibit construction on steep slopes. Mm-hmm. It requires special attention to prevent erosion and things like that. One of the differences with this plan as opposed to other rural clusters, this one is very unusual because it is served by public water and sewer. Now there are prohibitions on construction of, for example, septic systems on very steep slopes and wetlands, things like that. But there are no septic systems in this subdivision because it's served by public sewer. Also, there's no need for separation of wells because there aren't any wells served by public water. Now, so what the surveyor did, and he explained what he did, was that it's possible to construct a house on the slopes that he found and the slopes that were shown on the yield plan. It requires special attention to erosion and things like that. One of the specific questions that I asked was with respect to the construction of the roads, because there were the theoretical roads, which it's a yield plan, so they're theoretical, showed roads being built on steep slopes and what the slopes were. And I pointed that out as an item to be considered specifically with VDOT. And the report back was that they had discussed it with VDOT, and VDOT confirmed that it was within the range of design that VDOT would have approved.
Doesn't our ordinance say you can't build on a slope that's steeper than 20%?
No.
I thought it did.
It says that on a steep slope like that, care has to be taken to ensure that there's no erosion and things like that. It also does talk about the utilities, which is the critical difference in terms of this discussion with this subdivision as opposed to the typical one. Because of the typical one, like the one I live in, for example, you can't build a septic system in a wetland. You can't build it in a flood-prone area. You can't build it on a very steep slope. But there are none. And there are none in this case.
And we already have, maybe I'm misinterpreted, but we already have lots of houses built on dramatically steep slopes, the type that are on a ridge that, you know, it has a walkout basement going down, but the slope goes way down. But those are all around the county. Many of them are Lake Monticello, but all around the county.
What a lot of people don't understand is that a 20% slope is 2 feet and 10. So if you have a house that's 40 feet deep, the slope is going to be 8 feet. So a typical house that's at grade level on the front and has a walkout basement on the back may very well be at 20%. So it's now that's a critical element in terms of protecting against erosion and things like that. And it's, again, this is not my area of expertise, but I'm telling you my experience, that it makes it largely unsuitable, probably entirely unsuitable for septic systems, but not for construction, as long as there's special care taken to control erosion damage from the construction. So a lot of this is the only way the staff could have done more on this is to have commission this work to be redone by another surveyor. And nobody in the county has the expertise to do on-the-ground surveying. So we would have had to have an independent surveyor do it. And I've never seen that done. And it would certainly be, it would be very expensive.
And I'd like to make the point that a lot of this discussion hinges on the difference between the word practical and practicable. Mr. Payne can get to the more the legal distinction, but one is it could be financially feasible to do, or the other is, can you do it? In our ordinance, yeah, you can do it. And there's no distinction with, well, should we really spend a lot of money to practically put a house in, you know, on these steep slopes? It's not something that we consider. And that's one of the points of discussion we're planning to bring up.
So there's been two issues talked about that I'm understanding. Anyway. One, to ask staff to direct staff to revisit our current ordinances with a view towards potential changes. That process can begin and then go to the Planning Commission and ultimately on the board after that. The second question that was raised was to revisit Island Hill. So I need direction on both of those, if that's what I'm understanding correctly.
I think it's time to take a fresh look at our ordinances.
Okay.
I think it would be a good idea to create something other than just the cluster so that you have more options to live in the rural county.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a while. I think it's time to look at it.
And I'm a little reticent to think that it's a good idea to go visit that. And
visit
I'm not
what?
The rural cluster subdivision. I'm not suggesting you're saying that, but I would hope that the board would be a little more expansive here. I think if we're going to go look at rural cluster subdivision, we probably ought to take a hard look at the ordinances.
The whole thing,
all those types
right.
Of things, right. And I know what, I mean, we've certainly got our county attorney's office. I also know what the consultant's fees are for those types of things. I think it's important to do a broad, comprehensive look rather than just target on this one small thing.
This is a major project.
Yeah.
Oh, I know it is.
Do that, it's a major project. And and if you're going to do it, you should direct the Planning Commission to look into it.
And that's something that's going to be done in the next 3 months.
No,
this is over the next year or so.
I would suggest that if you're going to do this, you better think about putting it in the budget, because it almost certainly involves.
Can I turn off?
Last time we got a quote for rewriting it, like all the subdivision ordinance, was $50,000.
Yeah, it is, but I think we can direct the Planning Commission to take a good look at it and decide whether we need to do more than, at the very least, we can make the setback from the property around a cluster wider.
That's
easy.
That's a pretty quick, easy change.
That's,
yeah.
That's certainly a matter of good design.
Yeah. If you're talking about something like that, you know, a few targeted things, those are pretty easy, pretty non-controversial spreading out to other things. But if you want to look at kind of how we do business, then that's a much broader look. So
what I would suggest is direct the staff to raise this with the Planning Commission and let the Planning Commission determine the scope of the project.
And the board representative to the Planning Commission can bring it up and talk about it at that time.
I guess we can.
Yeah. No, but I'm surely, my voice would be there.
They represent to the Planning Commission as well, too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. We did a nice job and sort of opened our eyes to have, you know, how it could be different.
Who was
the man who presented?
Yeah.
Papadopoulos? Something like that.
Yeah.
But, and you know, because we might see a few more of these cluster subdivisions pop up pretty quickly, a couple of minor fixes, such as setbacks and so on, is something that we may want to consider doing sooner than later.
So maybe
it was a disappointment to see how Island Hill upset so many people. Right? You know.
I understand what you're saying, but there's not very many SUPs, by rights, zoning changes that don't upset somebody.
And I totally understand.
I think to satisfy future things, I think it's a good idea to take a look at least some targeted stuff. And if you want to go big after that, then that's a much bigger project, and you really do need to put some money in the budget for it. But
I thought we'd already put in instructions to review different zoning options as well to the planning commission, you know, how we could expand that. That was a discussion that we were already asking for, you know, do we need to look at
different zoning options? But that was just, you just talked about a couple weeks ago, though.
I'm not saying it's done, I'm just saying I think we're headed in that direction.
So how about this? We'll have Mr. Stewart present as part of his briefing to the planning commission, kind of the framework of this. Then Mrs. Eager can chime in, and depending on how expansive it gets, come back to the board for formal direction. Or if it's relatively targeted, let the planning commission do their work and they can present that through the chain.
To what I would call tweaking the rural cluster subdivision provisions is relatively easy, and it can be pretty well directed. So making the more extensive changes that Mrs. Eager, of the type Mrs. Eager was mentioning, is a major policy decision.
Surgical strike versus carpet bombing. So.
But this was something that was discussed in great detail and at great length when the ordinance was adopted the first time. And this would be partially rethinking that.
Yeah.
So it's you know, this is not something you want to go out and, oh, well, put this on the agenda for next week and fix it.
Oh, no, I don't think so.
So I think we've got direction on that to go by. Second issue was to revisit Island Hill. That was the second issue brought up.
I think Mrs. Eager's just asking that, you know, the Planning Commission make sure they dot their I's and cross their T's, which I'm sure they always do, with extra attention be brought to that because of sort of the upset neighbors from that standpoint. It is by right, there's much that can be done from that standpoint, but I don't want to put words in your mouth.
There was another thing that I was concerned about with the, we also probably ought to look at the last lot being allowed to be a lot rather than open space. Mm-hmm. I thought that was a good idea originally because as a farmer, if I couldn't keep my farm any longer, I didn't want to have to lose my home if I needed to do that, mm-hmm. to do a cluster. But maybe some portion of that lot should be dedicated to open space because it doesn't feel right to live in the rural area and have your lot not any bigger than mine was in Brooklyn. So I was hoping that they could have some walking area, maybe even it's just a circle around the back of it, but there should be some accommodation.
Yes, but that's a really good discussion, and I understand what you're saying. I don't disagree with that, but are you talking about retrospectively back to a process that's already been approved, or are you talking about looking at that going forward? Because okay. Those are two different distinct things.
Well, I guess we can't go backwards, we have to go forward.
Okay. So we're going to look at those types of things in concert with looking at the rural cluster subdivision and some tweaks here and tweaks there. If that then satisfies the board's intent, when you see what those tweaks are, and you're, as the planning commission representative, you'll see them first. If it does, then we're kind of done with that task. If it doesn't, then we may want to look at a bigger project.
Right.
But Island Hill subdivision is decided law, for lack of a better term.
So it's what?
Decided.
It's over with, in other words.
Yeah.
Well, they have to get their administrative approval.
Right. And then still VDOT has to do clearances on the roads and all those types of things. But from a zoning administrative point of view and the planning commission point of view, that by right subdivision has already been approved in the specifications that were laid forward, essentially, like it or not. I don't want to have staff have any ambiguity here. Because they get calls all the time, and I don't want them telling residents that, well, we're revisiting it. We're either revisiting it or not revisiting it.
Revisiting Island Hill?
Yes.
I'm asking, can we? Can you legally go back, and can we do that?
No.
Oh. Well, then that's the answer.
And that's why I wanted to have this kind of concrete discussion, because when you get calls, and you all are going to continue to get calls, it's, for a terrible term, it's decided law. It's a decided case already. And while we may want to fix things going forward, I think that's really important. And some of the things you've talked about seem like relatively makes sense, fixes to me, and not very hard.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that at the end of that meeting, it was clear to the majority of the folks there that, you know, it was going to happen. There wasn't anything the board could do. But we did tell them that, you know, we understood their pain and their concerns, and that we would talk about it here, and that we did think that there were some good ideas presented, and that the intent of the cluster subdivision, while good, isn't exactly being met in this example. And, you know, we live and learn as we do these things.
And their discussions are going to precipitate positive change, potentially.
They are, and that's what I said to them. I said, you guys have already made a change, because we are going to look at this and we'll make better cluster subdivisions going forward, right?
We have an almost 20-year data set of cluster subdivisions at this point that we can see what's working, what's not working.
Exactly. Exactly. So, and this was just a very unique one, just the way the layout of land was and what the intent of the developer was, and with public water there. But we're going to have more public water, and so we'll see more of these things.
Right. But it probably wasn't the best in the world, the way it turned out. But that's the law. It's done with, and we move on. I mean, really, that's where you are.
I don't disagree with that. Can we make better ones?
Our review, the county's review, is not to ensure that it's the best design you can have, but that it's a design that meets our criteria.
Current ordinance.
Now, if we need to tweak the criteria, that's certainly within the board's discretion.
Absolutely.
And the people who met were respectful to the county. Mm-hmm. And I think we both suggested that they stay in contact with the developer and try to work with him.
Sure, absolutely.
Because he ultimately can, at this point, hear their problems with it and maybe work with them.
Yeah. Be engaged with the planning commission meetings.
I know that they have been, because I've talked had occasion to talk to the developer's attorney, talk about something else, and this came up, and she told me that they had already had they already begun those discussions.
Yep.
Now, one thing that you do have to remember is one of the things she mentioned was that one of the Broken Island people said, well, you need to have, I think it was a 200-foot setback, and on the lots next to me, and you couldn't do that. You couldn't put a 200-foot setback and still have a lot there. So what you have to remember is the applicant for approval is subject to review and regulation. You are subject to review and regulation. The neighbors are not. So their ideas may produce a better subdivision, but that doesn't mean it's necessarily the only one you can have.
Okay. So we'll get back to the planning commission and start that process.
Well, is there any other unfinished business that needs to be discussed?
I have some. I attended talked to you about this. I attended a meeting with LMOA officials. Mr. Hurwitz was there, the chief of police from Lake Monticello, and I think the grounds person. And VDOT had the engineer from Northern Virginia came down, and I guess Culpeper he's from, and Alan Saunders and another person was there, and myself. And they talked about the dangers of the Monish Tufton Gate. And I guess you're pulling it up here. Mm-hmm. There have been, I think they had a list of about 20 accidents that have happened there recently. And what they came away with is they agreed that this was a very dangerous area, and particularly with the potential for Colonial Hill coming in. So what they thought what they could do is do right in, right out, and eliminate left in, left out.
So for orientation, at the top of the screen up here, when I go up, that's Effort Baptist Church.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And when you come down a little bit farther, this is that side gate into mm-hmm. Lake Monticello on Route 53.
Yep.
That's called the Monish Gate. That's the one that's notoriously difficult because this used to be a 55-mile-an-hour zone. It's 45 now. When the traffic circle comes in up here, this will have some traffic slowing, properties, which is great, but Mrs. Eager's talking about this specific entrance and having a potential for a right-in, right-out only. So when
you it's been a problem ever since.
Yes, sir. I mean, there's not a lot of land here because this drops off pretty precipitously on this side.
It does.
And this is, you know, VDOT right away here, but then it gets right into private property, lake property and private individual property. So from a traffic point of view, if you're coming out of the lake, you could only turn right. If you were coming into the lake, you could only turn right going in. You couldn't come from Charlottesville and turn left into that gate across traffic, because that's the most dangerous style.
The real problem is that this entrance is designed for right in and right out.
I mean, yes, just a different force.
You can see it right there on the picture. You see where the arrow is?
Yeah, they added the
That's turn a right turn lane.
Right.
There is no left turn lane. And I mean, I was noticing that the other day. If you're driving from Effort going toward
Food Line,
you see this right away. It's particularly obvious when there's no traffic there. When there's traffic there, you can't see anything. It's so bound up.
Yeah.
And I think right in, right out's going to raise some hackles, I'm sure.
That would almost have been a roundabout there, not that you necessarily do it, but that would actually have solved that.
Well, it would, except it's just too little traffic.
Yeah, I know there. It is.
Well, for that gate,
I'm just,
and the land doesn't support
this entrance would never be approved today.
Right.
So what Ms. Eager was talking about is that right in, right out, when the traffic circle gets finished. And so if you came out, theoretically, if you came out this gate and needed to go to Food Line, you could come out, go up, go to the traffic circle, make a traffic circle U-turn, and go back down to Food Line.
And it's only a quarter of a mile from the gate to the circle.
Americans are notoriously not interested in how far it is. It's something they didn't want to do. So we're going to have lots of outcry.
And that's the reason, what the police
the reason
said. The
reason discussion is because it's in Mr. Weaver's district. And you have a lot of lake residents too, because you're on inside of Jefferson. All those ones on the outside of Jefferson are Mr. Weaver's district. And so just be prepared for it.
That's I think all it's his a district.
Tactical, huh?
The right in will be very challenging for a lot of residents there, because they'll have to go around the lake.
The problem is the residents coming back that live on that side of the lake either have to go down and turn around, or go in the turkey side gate, or go in the main gate.
Right.
Now there is another possibility. The lake owns a lot on 618,
yes,
very close to Effort.
Yeah,
and
up here.
They could easily do another gate, but it would be at the lake's expense.
Out here, they've talked about for years trying to put a gate in.
Right there.
That is not on the main 53 highway. You'd have the same right in, right out problems and crossing traffic there, but it's not on as heavy a thoroughfare. The problem is if you're moving all the 53 traffic to that thoroughfare to come in that gate, you're going to just increase traffic. But the lake's talked about that for years, and it's certainly
The right-in would be solved there.
Right-in would be great for the folks coming home, but trying to go to work in the morning, where would you come out?
Go the other way.
You can go out the Monash gate. If you did right-in, right-out on both of them, you could do that. That's right.
Yeah. No, and it will ultimately be the lake's issue, because it isn't really VDOT's issue. So the outcry from lake residents will almost guarantee that exit will be built, is my guess, by the lake.
Yeah, I just want to make sure that you all are understand and are prepared for.
Sure.
The rabbit is maybe too strong, but the very vocal complaints and concerns you'll hear about this one if it turns to right in, right out.
I think it's what we should do.
Fantastic safety improvement, but it'll have to be really
do town halls. Coordinated means with the lakes.
I'm not going to those town halls, sorry.
No, but I mean, it's going to be bad. Residents, of course, are very aware of how dangerous
you
that
wouldn't
is.
Be here.
I mean, everybody knows how dangerous that is.
Yeah. And indeed.
It's the right thing to do.
Yeah.
It's the right thing to do.
So this is supposed to be starting to be constructed in early 2020, this roundabout. And so this will be after, in concert with the completion of that.
Right.
And plenty of time to start talking about it.
The engineer thought that since there would be a traffic pattern change, that would be a good time to do the whole
thing. Yeah, let them be all mad about 37 things instead of just one thing every 6 months.
Right.
It probably is easier that way.
Yeah.
And surely we'll be safe.
Yeah. And that is up to VDOT. I mean, the lake doesn't really have anything to say about it because it's in their right of way.
Absolutely. Is there anything else? Old or new business?
And I just wanted to give credit to Trey House Connect, the young boy who brought this to my attention. And he's a boy working for badges for his Eagle Scout.
Oh, yeah. Okay. That's good.
He's only about 12.
Yeah.
And it was Alan said, well, I know that you have to, when you're doing it for an Eagle Scout, you have to get involved. He said, well, make sure that we have something for Trey to do.
On a new business, anything?
No.
Mrs. Spears, do you want to
talk something
about Mr. Pullen's request there?
About the
finance charge.
Oh, for the ambulances.
Yeah.
Yeah. We could talk. We met with Andrew Pullen last night, and he showed us the trucks and the condition of the trucks. And one of the things I think I asked him about, he brought it up. There's a woman who's in her late 80s, and she had fallen and needed to go to the hospital. And she didn't want to go because she didn't want the expense, because she had gone to the hospital previously, and she was trying to pay $50 a month to pay off the $900 over what her medical insurance would pay. So he said, well, wait a minute, and he brought it to the attention of the county, and then I think the county wrote that off because we have that policy. If you can't afford it, that will absorb it. So, but he said it's not well known throughout the county, and so people make these, who are on Social Security or limited income, try to pay the county when it might be kinder for us to make that known. But that's okay. Just a suggestion.
So yes, and it's really good, and we've beaten this 57,000 times. There are always gonna be people that don't know they can ask for that, but the people in the know, all the fire and rescue folks and all the county officials and things, all know that. It is a very simple system. What you cannot do by law, you cannot say, you know, just let us know and we'll forgive that. It cannot be done. It Medicare will hammer.
That's right. He told us that.
Yeah, and so we really agree with that. We want to make sure that people know that this is a compassionate billing system, and if they've got financial difficulties, it's a very simple process to give us some information, interface with the county, and in almost all cases, with very small amount of work, we can help them. We just have to follow a real process, because otherwise it's bad.
Yeah, he said that really, you have to send the bill to the person who has used the service, mm-hmm. and otherwise the insurance won't accept it. They won't pass.
Sure. Right. Well, and Medicare has laws and rules about what we can bill and what we can forgive. You can't just automatically write it off. But mm-hmm. It is a good idea to always kind of pound out there again that there are systems in place to help those in need. So if you could all foot stomp that when you're out at meetings and stuff, we'll certainly try to do that too. And then
reinforce
it with all the fire and rescue folks.
His point was that it's not as known. It's not out there. Mm-hmm. So it's up to the citizens to help other people understand what it really entails.
Yeah, and also maybe we can foot stomp it with the rescue personnel, because the rescue folks often hear from a family member or the patient, oh gosh, I don't want to pay for this. It's just going to add to the stress. Yeah. They often talk about that along the way or when they're at the house to pick somebody up. So we'll reemphasize with the rescue folks to
that would
make
be
sure
good.
They bring that up too.
I don't know if there's like a statement that rescue can give out, like a little document that explains our policy for the person to be able to.
They do give a policy.
They do.
Yes.
And my guess is that the average person
doesn't read it.
We tried to make it really simple and pretty easy to follow, but it still is in the midst of being hauled to the hospital in an ambulance.
Sure.
You know,
sure,
it's
sure.
hard to think about that stuff, but it surprises me that there's a $900 leftover on an ambulance bill.
Yeah.
Especially for a Medicare person, that's really unusual. Yeah.
That's what he said, isn't it?
I wonder if it's the medical bill writ large, because the medical bill for an ambulance is only about $900 total.
Yeah.
at the highest with an ALS ambulance. So it's unusual that a Medicare beneficiary would have $900 out of their pocket for the ambulance, but it's possible. I guess it depends on certain circumstances, but it's not very usual.
The second issue he raised was with regard to the outstanding financing interest charges that they have been paying. And I guess they spoke to you, Mr. Dahl, a little bit about that, and there's some confusion. And he just asked for clarification as to whether or not they would have to pay this coming year or not. Their budget, they gave us here's an example of their budget. They didn't have a successful fundraising last year because of weather. And so the previous year, they had a shortfall in their budget of about $10,000 or so. And so he said it would obviously make a big difference if this interest payment wasn't due coming up. And the board may want to consider whether or not they provide some additional funding from that standpoint, if it is due. But he just asked for clarification so they know how to adjust their budget.
So far for the current fiscal year 19, out of the three stations, the three companies that owe the interest payment finance charge, two of them have paid so far. Kent Store has not paid the county. The county has invoiced each one of them for their portion of the payment.
Yeah, I think he thought that the 10 years was up, and he...
10 years is not up.
And is it up this year?
It's up this year. After this payment, as I told them before, after this payment's made for 19, that payment is gone for them.
My understanding is I think he was aware of that. He was wondering whether there was going to be a payment next year. It sounds like that's not going to be...
No, not for that particular one. This... Well, and I've talked to their treasurer and some other folks there too that I put on the thing that this is the final payment, and that was even last year when we had the discussion when they made their payment last year, because they paid in just slightly above what the payment was. And I'd say, you know, I told them then that we'd apply it towards what is going to be their final payment in fiscal year 19.
And for the 25th or 3,000th time, I'll reiterate, it doesn't make any sense to me whatsoever that our volunteer fire and rescue squads have to pay for any administrative stuff. Debt service costs. Taking out the debt service for the truck, why is there anything like that? It's because it's always been done that way.
And I'll say
no reason, other reason, because we've pulled in insurance, we've pulled in, you know, paying electric bills. Why do we want our volunteers to have to deal with that stuff when they're the best value around? Let the county staff deal with the administrative stuff. Let them do the technical stuff. Let them decide, you know, what to wear when they run into a burning building. But
well, can
it's,
we?
It's changed, and so
it can't it be changed that we have sold
the board could say, yeah, we forgive all the rest of the payments that are owed to the county.
And that's up to us.
That's up to the board.
Oh yes, but I wouldn't necessarily want to forgive all the rest of it. I want you to.
You could say going forward.
Do it forward. Going forward, the county, when they finance a fire truck, pays the finance payer.
And some of the money.
Why was ever set up that way where the company would pay the interest on it?
And it's not necessarily the interest. What it is the county said we're going to pay up to a certain amount.
Yeah,
let's just say $500,000, and since we, you know, amortize it over 10 years, it's $50,000 a year, and then whatever the payment turns out to be, because sometimes they want a different paint job or they want some other types of equipment added to the truck that maybe is above and beyond what's needed, so they can choose to go that route, and then they pay what is the addition for that. So
and I'm of the opinion that a fire company ought to put something on the CIP that's the full cost of getting that thing from need to on the street. Yeah. It doesn't mean that the county's gonna disprove the paint they wanna do it or the equipment they wanna do it. What does it take to make that thing you're buying fully operational?
And some of the
nickel and dime or do it out of three different pots.
Some of the companies have also used their state fire money to reimburse the county for their portion of the equipment for trucks.
Yeah, if they're getting money from someplace where it's not hurting their operational stuff and they want to contribute to some of those things, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But it seems like an odd kind of convoluted process that could be simplified and absolutely still get the companies and squads what they want.
Yeah, so for fiscal year 20, we've got these four different apparatus in there for debt service. The board can certainly say that, yeah, going forward, you know, we're not going to you know, we're not going to require payback or anything like that for any portion. Whatever the debt service payment is what the county,
sure,
is what the county has.
We try to reiterate that with them as well, too.
Yeah, and I think should that on the 17th of your work session, you could.
I'm sorry.
Should
that be on the agenda to
going forward? Well, the work session on the 17th, we'll have it as an item for you to talk about that night.
Okay.
Because my question to a company would be, okay, what does it take to buy that tanker to make it fully operational? If it's $462,000, then that's what the debt service is, $462,000. And why would we want to have, we pay this and then they reimburse the interest on it or the extra cost? What's it cost to make it operational? Now, in the world of odd stuff, let's assume they want to put a disco ball on top of a truck. Maybe the county doesn't want to pay for that. But I don't see anything that the squads and companies are doing that's weird. It's to make the truck functional.
Mm-hmm.
So.
And that's costly to
to the outfit taxpayers of Fluvanna County.
Yeah, to outfit the truck. After you buy it, it's very costly to outfit it.
When you buy a car, you don't buy it and then assume somebody else is going to pay for the you know, the heated seats you put in or the air conditioning or whatever. It's what you want, and to make it functional and ready to go, it's a complete package. It's just because it's always been done that way. Any reason why we couldn't change it?
No, we certainly could change it. I mean that's an entire decision for the board to make. It's always been.
Professionals who want the stuff ought to tell you, here's what we need to make it fully operational. That's what they're asking for on the CIP. If you approve it on the CIP, it's funded by the county. Yeah. And there shouldn't have to be change in dollars of hands. That's kind of silly. Let them use their fundraising dollars for the special stuff or the outfitting of, you know, of like turnout gear or specialty things for their company.
I mean, this kind of goes back to the whole discussion of standardized equipment for the county. It would be nice if there was more standardized trucks for the county, and this is what's needed.
He did raise it, and we asked about that question.
And different areas have different specifications, well, or maybe some different things that they need for the truck.
Don't try to paint them all the same.
Don't try to paint them. Yeah. Now, he did highlight, for example, that some of the trucks that are servicing the lake, the height requirements for those are quite different than the trucks that they use servicing other areas. So, you know, it was good. It was educational, and I think keeping the conversation going is something that we should continue to do with the FRA.
We'd be delighted to have
it. And I think they're open to that
on an ongoing basis.
So I was encouraged and would certainly ask that we continue to have some opportunities to meet with them in the next 6 months to keep this conversation going. So I think that's would be positive.
Yeah, I mean, at the end of the day, right now, for the current fiscal year, we're getting $24,000 a year from them for reimbursement for above and beyond what, if you want to call it, interest payments or add-ons or whatever it is. So $24,000, it's a lot of money, but at the end of the day, it's not going to make or break the county's budget per se. But that's a board decision. If going forward they don't want to get in the weeds of having the companies having to reimburse the county, we can certainly do that.
It just seems really silly.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
It does.
Somebody agreed to it years ago, so that's the way it's been, and it's always seemed kind of silly, but
All right. Any other new business?
One more thing. I had a constituent contact me, and she was concerned about unsecured trash, so this will be directed to you, Sheriff S. She was on the road, and a piece of wood fell off of a truck. Not a pickup truck, but she said it was a wider back, and it was full of firewood. She hit it and blew her tire and almost caused an accident, and the car behind her hit it. So she was, and she cited Virginia law on securing loads. And I was wondering if you could ticket more people who have things flying out of their car, particularly on 250.
Yes, ma'am, we do ride those tickets. Mm-hmm. Actually, there's a trooper that works county too that looks for the commercial vehicles, and when he inspects them, he checks that also. But yes, we have written tickets for that, and as well as littering. But you know, most of the littering, like I see at my farm, it happens at night. You know, and it's a terrible thing. And last week I picked up three different times I picked up large cardboard, trash, and stuff that was in the middle of the road keeping having accidents. And it happens all the time, especially on your main thoroughfares or around six people going to the dump. It's, you know, like Mr. Weaver, you can drive down Route 6 and almost see a whole bag of trash that's blown off somebody's vehicle. But when we see it, we decide.
See, I think you can give a ticket even if something hasn't fallen out of the truck if it's not secure.
If it's not secure, yes, ma'am. There's a code section, a state code section for unsecured loans.
Okay. Anyway, I told her I would tell you about this.
I actually got an email.
From the same person?
Well, I don't know if it was from the same person, but somewhere down, things got back to me, and we made sure that all the deputies knew those code sections.
Okay, thank you.
How do you define a secured load? How do you find that? I mean, if it's firewood, if it's so high and all, and if it's still even with the backboard, is that secure, or does it mean it's supposed to be maybe 6 inches below, so if something moves, there'll be a backboard? What is secure?
That's why you have different code sections. Dump trucks and hauling equipment, they have these covers that are mandated.
I've seen those plenty of times.
If you have somebody like me, I'm driving down the road, I got some firewood in the back of my truck, and it falls off, and there's an accident, yes, I'm be responsible for that because I didn't put it in there properly. I didn't tie it down. I didn't put a net over it. So under one of those sections, you're going to get charged. So between the three, you can make it work. It's a commercial vehicle. Fine is much greater. But there, one way or the other, you're responsible for what's in your vehicle and on your vehicle or your trailer. Not long ago, we had one on 15 where the trailer was overloaded and the tires, the dry ride, and the tires just blew completely off the trailer and caused an accident. There were several summons written for that one.
The other thing, excuse me, following up the sheriff's comment, the word responsible, that statute provides a remedy, a civil remedy, for anybody that's damaged, whether it's the highway or another vehicle or whatever it might be. In other words, that lady has a right to sue this guy.
She didn't get his license plate.
Yeah. It's difficult because you get your window broken by a rock off a dump truck. The dump truck is liable, but you got to get the license and know what's going on.
And maybe you get a witness.
It might be.
Oh, you certainly would.
So
you could be a witness yourself, but you could end up somebody.
Someone on 250 hit a cow, and they never could find out whose cow that was.
I think
because the cow.
I drove by there that night.
You did.
Mm-hmm. What about the superintendent?
Cow wouldn't talk.
That hit I guess it was a cow and killed him on the interstate.
Wow.
Our superintendent. One of our superintendents.
Holy cow.
You remember that?
I thought it was a horse.
Well, maybe it was a horse.
I think it was a horse.
Came from the stockyard down there.
Yeah. Was it a cow?
Not on the interstate.
It was superintendent. Yeah, county administrators are more prone to bullying.
Yeah.
Well, moving on. We will now move to our second round of public comments. Anyone wishing to address the board should come to the podium and state your name and address. Please remember to keep your comments for 5 minutes on topic and directed to the board. Anyone wishing to address the board at this time?
They're waiting in line.
They are. Seeing no one wishing to speak, we will close the second round of public comments. There is no closed session. So I would entertain a motion.
So on the screen, just before you go, this is the updated calendar. Remember, April 10th, there's nothing. April 17th, your regular meeting, but you got a budget work session at 4. Then April 24th is when you'll have the special meeting to adopt budget. Then you're back on regular schedule.
You could do an iPad anyway.
Yes, sir.
Dispel your ignorance if you share it with me. CANX means canceled.
Sorry.
Very good.
Need a motion to adjourn, please.
Certainly.
Motion has been made by Mr. Weaver.
Second.
Seconded by Mrs. Eager. May I vote?
Aye.
Chair votes aye. Motion passes 3-0. We are adjourned.
Thank you.